Hello there and welcome to the Culturefile weekly Oktoberfest edition, for which there's no beer or lederhosen, just a noticeable chill in the air. We celebrate with novelist Sarah Stridsberg, who's been trying to discover the real meaning of Valerie Solanas, the woman who shot Andy Warhol. Rob Long is here to pour another martini shot a little bit later, and we'll go in search of everything we've learned since March about making art online. But first, Valerie Solanas is best known as the woman who, at the factory in New York in 1968, shot Andy Warhol. Spoiler, he lived. Solanas, too, survived until 1988, and her book, The Scum Manifesto, even longer. The manifesto became something of a cult classic and has inspired a flurry of recent activities, such as Polly Wiseman's play Femme Fatale, which we heard about recently on Culturefile, as well as Andrea Long Chu's book Females, and even an episode of American Horror Story, in which Lena Dunham played Solanas. Also, a little under Solanas' spell as our guest this time, Sarah Stridsberg. Stridsberg wrote a novel based on Solanas' life more than a decade ago, but only last year was nominated for the Man Booker International Prize. So why now has Valerie Solanas finally found her allies and her moment? Áine Gallagher met with Sarah over Zoom to hear more about Valerie, Sarah, and their literary relationship.
I'm Sara Stridsberg, and I'm sitting in Stockholm, where I live in Sweden, and I'm a writer, so I spend my days at this table, actually, in my home, writing, and we're going to talk about a book that I wrote, actually. It was published in Sweden 14 years ago. It's called Valerie in the US and the Faculty of Dreams in Britain, so since it's kind of historical novel, even if I'm not loyal to the few historical facts that are known. In a way, it's a novel about many Valeries, other bag ladies, other prostitutes, with brilliant notes in their handbags. I often think that to being able to write a book, you have to be able to hear voices that are not your own voices. You have to be able to hear foreign voices, which is also a sign of psychosis. So you have to be a little bit out of your mind. And I really like that feeling of not being me. So it's always a tragedy to leave a book behind. But once I left it behind, it's dead to me. You know how it's like when an old love, somebody you had a romantic affair with like 15 years ago. The memory is very sweet, but you don't want to come close to that person again.
Hey, how many bullets can you get for $5?
What for?
Andy Warhol.
And you were the first person to translate the Scum Manifesto into Swedish. And I just discovered what the acronym is, the Society for Cutting Up Men.
Yeah, I translated it while writing the novel. Because she wasn't, nobody knew about her in Sweden. And I think that before reading the manifesto, I had the impression that it would be a quite boring pamphlet, you know, very pedagogical, feminist thing that would educate you in gender equality. And actually, it was something radically different. I had never read anything like it. It was so strange and so unique in a way. And I was like gravitated towards her because of her paradoxes. To me, it's deep down, the manifesto is a clear anti-violence manifesto, since it's a satire, like Jonathan Swift's satire. I often think of that. A Modest Proposal. And she works a little bit in the same way. You know, when she describes the worst men types, of course she mentions the rapists, but also bad disc jockeys and lousy musicians. So I had the feeling that I saw life coming through me. I saw the contours of the loneliest girl in the world. And I was obsessed with this text because I was wondering what kind of an experience a person could have had to write such a, in a way, funny dystopia and tragic utopia. And I saw this life coming through me. The writer of the manifesto, she's a person who don't believe in anything, nor in God, fatherhood, family, philosophy, architecture. It's like she's deconstructing all the things that are essential to our civilization. And she has no illusions at all. And I think that what she really taught me was to forget everything they ever taught me. I had this as a mantra while writing. Forget everything they ever taught you. There are no truths. She was the pacifist who tried to kill Andy Warhol, since theory is much easier than life. And she's also the intellectual whore. She's the child without childhood. She's the ultra-feminist with no contact with contemporary feminist movement at all.
I think the word radical would often be associated with her, radical feminist. Yeah. But of course that term is just such a blanket term, and it really doesn't allow for any other discussions to go on.
No, I don't know how to define her. She would hate any definition, I think. And I tried to write a novel where I would comfort her and letting her be free. I'm always trying, not only in this novel, but in other novels that I wrote too, I'm always trying to describe my characters without destroying them. I think you can call her a radical feminist, but I think it's not strong enough, because she was interesting to me, because she was the feminist that the feminists hated. I think that the radical feminists of that time, she was too complicated for them. She was an outsider. And what interests me are all the characters that wouldn't fit in any context. That is, she's too filthy for the feminist movement. She was never interested in gender equality. That's what that's what feminists do. They work for gender equality. She wanted to blow the whole thing up. She didn't believe in anything. She didn't even believe in beliefs. She didn't believe in theories. She had no illusions. In my book, she comes from the desert. She's a desert girl living with her mother, who's obsessed with men and obsessed with trying to kill herself. And she's wandering slowly into the big history of the 60s. The real Valerie Solana said, "I want this to stay in my competent hands," when they offered her lawyers for the trial. She wanted to do everything herself. She wanted nobody to defend her. And trying to kill somebody, we can never really explain such an act. I don't know if she knew why she did it. She said herself, "He had too much control over my life." But many people has a lot of control over many people's lives. So the question might be, why don't every desperate woman shoot somebody?
I stopped my rambling.
Do you think the climate of contemporary feminism, be it in Sweden or in Europe, do you think it has space for figures like Valerie Solanas?
No, I don't think any world has space for figures like Valerie Solanas, and that's the grand challenge to us all as human beings, to find ways to house all these characters that are difficult to deal with, that are not easily lovable. So that's a huge challenge for me, both in my life and in my writing. But the answer is no. There aren't space for the outsiders, the freaks. And that's kind of interesting with the Andy Warhol as well, because he said that the freaks, they are the real aristocrats. And still, the factory that housed a lot of freaks, in a way, all kinds of people could come there. And Andy, he made art of them. Maybe he used them, maybe he lifted them from something. There are many theories about that, but still, Valerie Solanas was too much of an outsider, even for the freaks that attended the factory. So it's a challenge to find space for all the misfits of the world.
Please don't confront me with my failure.
Sarah Stridsberg there, and the reporter was Aunya Gallagher. The Faculty of Dreams is out now, as is Valerie in the US, which is the same book. And next, The Art of the Stream. As spaces for performances and even exhibitions in our brick and blood world were curtailed by the pandemic, artists and performers of all sorts looked to the internet as a vital replacement space. Early efforts were urgent experiments, but after 6 months, what have we learned about offering experiences online? I issued a Zoom invite to Jennifer O'Mara, a lecturer in film studies at TCD, to join me in some live streams.
Well, it happened quite rapidly. It happened sort of overnight, where you saw particularly musicians and theatre practitioners move online very suddenly and try to adapt to that in terms of people filming often themselves at home and filming themselves through Zoom or different digital platforms and trying to adapt their work to make it work for a screen-based medium. So everything becoming filtered through particular camera angles, or the space in front of the camera suddenly being very important to everyone, seeing what's in shot, what's out of shot, and also having to adapt to sound-related challenges.
What struck me instantly as people did try to do their work online is that a lot of the language seemed to be derived from places where they already lived. So a singer would go online, but it would become very much a performance was like a video conference or a TikTok story, and people's work was sort of being crowbarred into those kind of formats.
Definitely. People were working with the existing platforms. And as you say, in terms of, say, TikTok or Instagram, that they were making very short videos often. They were using often filters. They were kind of superimposing text or graphics onto the screen, the ones that the site made very easy to kind of add. So you were getting that sense of this merging of what the performance might have been like in a different time, and then how it was being remediated basically for the COVID time, and using whatever platforms we had at that time, at that point.
Place where I often get stuck is that there already is a kind of an audiovisual language where things are pre-recorded. There's cinema, there's television, and as you say, there are various websites. But there's this other thing where we are all together in a place, and that has its own forms, its own language. And they're not necessarily completely compatible. One of the basic things is we're not in the room together, and being in the room together is the premium on those kind of experiences.
That kind of sense of communal sharing of experiences has obviously been missing, and And the idea of everyone sort of sitting in their own home, in their own space, while there are benefits to it, I think people did miss that sense of being able to monitor other people's reactions. And so you saw different strategies that people were using, whether it's sort of live tweeting things as they're watching, or with the so-called co-video parties where people were watching an agreed film at an agreed time and commenting live again on that to get a sense of shared experience that I think is important. And it's something people look forward to maybe as much as, you know, the theatre, the musical performance itself, but that sense of atmosphere that comes with it.
And I mean, it seemed to be almost what was ignored immediately, in that people thought if they just presented in front of you at a certain moment, like the contemporaneity of it would deliver the essence of presence, I suppose.
Yeah. And I think it's really drawn attention to the value of things like editing in terms of film and TV and other screen media, the idea of getting rid of the kind of dead time and the importance of changing angles in order to create a more dynamic atmosphere. And all of that is lost, of course, when you have someone just live streaming, for example, and it's quite monotonous. You're basically going back to early cinema in terms of having a fixed camera and no movement and just a long take. All the things that were initially criticised about filmmaking, and that was a necessity because of the size of the cameras and the big recording sound recording equipment that meant you couldn't move things around, and everyone has kind of been forced back into that model by having to use their own limited technology to record things. I can think of particular photographers whose work in terms of capturing the COVID times are really effective, like the photographer Ruth Medjibar, who took a lot of window portraits of people during the early stages of lockdown around Dublin. And she was finding a way to take photos, take portraits at a distance. And she would take all of these at twilight, and she would use the existing window frames and the windowsills as a kind of picture frame, and the light from inside the house to light up the photo. And it created some really distinctive images. And I think it was someone who kind of worked with what they had in an effective way. But I think a lot of the recorded theatre performances or music performances did suffer to a certain degree. And particularly with the scale of the screens people might have been watching them on, where everything is suddenly very small for the most part. And you kind of miss out on some of those nuances in terms of expressions and, you know, being able to see someone play their instrument properly and all that.
And of course, sound quality.
Yes.
One of the approaches people took, which I found quite strange, was this idea of introducing an artificial scarcity. Because we imagine once a performance is going on online, there's an infinite amount of people. The audience is possibly infinite, although the amount of people who might be interested is another matter. But people did have this idea that tickets were selling out and then new tickets would be released. And these were all for people who weren't going to take up any space. What was that compulsion to add some kind of scarcity to it? I guess it's related to the preciousness of a live situation, which isn't happening.
Yeah, I think, and in some cases, those call outs or those notifications about claiming tickets or booking tickets, it can be the artist or the people doing the event, their way of actually drumming up interest, you know, saying tickets are limited, you know, trying to get it to drum up some more demand, and maybe for them to actually get a sense of how many people are actually going to show up. Because I think that's one of the fears with these online events or the live events, that people might not commit to them, or that they might, you know, not even remember that they're happening. So that maybe they want them to sign up for a ticket just so they can send them reminders like an hour before or 24 hours before.
There's also the level of attention that you might give, which you sort of touch on there, that when you're watching on your phone or indeed your laptop, you will be as distracted as you would be watching a normal television programme, and unlike you would be, say, at a gig or at a theatre performance. And also that tendency then not to complete it, I guess, comes into it. You know, if it's not particularly grabbing you, there's no social stigma about just tuning out, switching off, going elsewhere.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's something you notice particularly, or I notice in the cinema, where you know, I never pay as full attention to a film outside of the cinema. And that idea of being distracted by things around you, the idea that you can always pause things and come back to it. And I mean, I've even had that experience recently where I was watching something live online and I almost went to pause it thinking that I could. So yeah, that sense that we get back some of the control there, but from the perspective of, you know, an artist or a filmmaker or whoever, they would rather we give things our full attention, of course, and not be distracted by our phones or, you know, the TV or getting like a cup of tea or whatever.
Culture Night was one of the big nights where this kind of came into incredible focus, in that this is the night in which we are all supposed to get out into the streets and be mingling at various cultural events. And so then that was pretty much off the cards. But some people did interventions that seemed quite interesting, to find a way to make a local community art centre have some kind of vitality, even when it's closed. And I think one of the things we were looking at was Visual Carlo, where they have sort of a compilation album of video art pieces which were recorded, filmed specifically for this event.
This was an interesting one. As you say, it was very much like some kind of variety show. So there was 7 different works by 8 artists. So some of them were kind of working together, and a lot of them were filmed or recorded anyway in the space of Visual in Carlo. So it was a kind of mixture of a few short films, some musical performances, some spoken word, some dance sequences, and quite a few of them were a kind of merging of different formats.
I was particularly taken with Toby Omoteso's piece, where the videographer and the dancer were working together, and that gave it a little extra life.
Yeah, definitely. And there was a few moments in that where that really came into focus. For example, at one point, it kind of creates a break when he moves towards the camera and sort of puts his hand over it. And then when he removes it, it's in a darkened space. So yeah, it was quite dynamic. And there was that sense of using the camera and sort of responding to it at this.
Because sometimes that seems to be what's missing from these online performances, is that in that piece, we watching it were really brought into it and kind of implicated as the eye that was watching. Where sometimes it's a performance that's just happening and there's a camera there.
Yeah, and I think creating something quite dynamic for the screen is a challenge that a lot of theatre practitioners, dancers, musicians are facing, and maybe having to learn very quickly about things like camera angles and shot lengths and what works and what doesn't in order to keep audiences engaged. I think people's attention spans, particularly when watching performances online, can be shorter.
In the present moment, what's missing from all of these online performances is us, is the audience. And there's always that funny moment where somebody, and it happened quite a few times in the Visual pieces, that somebody finishes and maybe they're waiting. And you can imagine a lifetimes of stage training. They're waiting for some sort of appreciation. It seems that aspect of letting us head into their space is not really being exploited.
Yeah, and I imagine for performers, that lack of applause is probably forcing them to live through maybe some of their worst fears. One thing I noticed when I was watching it, it was streaming live on YouTube, and so you were able to see the comments and you were able to see, you know, how many people were watching at a given time. So you did get a sense of, you know, the numbers. So I think there was, when I was looking at it anyway, maybe 60 people or so, and you were seeing their comments, and to a certain extent it was a bit distracting. You know, I was torn between watching the actual content and reading the comments and thinking about who are these people commenting and do they know the artist or the dancer. I imagine it's probably good for the events organizers and the artists to actually get a sense that people are watching and people are listening, and that, you know, all of this work isn't just going to remain online, but, you know, not be viewed.
Jennifer O'Mara there, and Jennifer will be back to review more online experiences in a fortnight's time. And finally, this time on the Culture File Weekly, we're ready to pour another martini shot with writer and producer Rob Long. And this time, Rob has been in the coffee shop encountering fame.
This is Rob Long with Martini Shot. I have a famous friend you've never heard of, who was recently presented with an expensive watch. It was one of those enormous clunky things that sits on the wrist like a very shiny hockey puck, and my friend was particularly proud of it. So proud, in fact, that he immediately posted a photograph on his Instagram account of the watch on his wrist. It was a gift, you see, from the company that makes the watches, which shouldn't be surprising if you've been paying attention to your social media channels. They sent him the watch to wear because he is what people call an influencer. And what's supposed to happen is this. You follow him on some social media platform, pick your favorite, Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, Instagram, TikTok. He's on all of them. And you see the watch and you think, wow, this guy on Instagram seems cool. And if he thinks this watch is cool, it must be. So I will allow him to influence me to buy that watch, even though he got it for free, which is the only reason he's wearing it in the first place. You and I may spend our humdrum working hours toiling away like modern-day galley slaves, but there are some people who have figured out the trick to the good life. You just amass a zillion followers on Instagram and offer yourself up to the fashion brands. Get famous on Instagram, and you'll soon be sporting a wristwatch that costs somewhere north of $25,000. This is what I call the democratization of celebrity. For years, high-end luxury brands have lavished gifts on the Hollywood famous, the original influencers, in the hope that someone will photograph the recipient wearing or carrying or displaying or whatever the bit of swag. But the definition of stardom has changed over the past decade as the media choices have fragmented into a kaleidoscope of channels and streamers and apps. It's possible to be a very famous person that no one has ever heard of. On a different morning at the same local coffee shop, I saw a scruffy and disheveled young man drinking a cappuccino and eating a pistachio croissant, which meant that, despite the outfit, he was probably not homeless. Also, he was wearing a t-shirt with the name of an obscure, to me, designer on it. "That's not an obscure designer," a friend of mine told me when I pointed him out. "That's his name. He's wearing a t-shirt with his own name on it." "How do you know?" I asked. "Because I recognize him from his old show on the Disney Channel," my friend said. "I mean, I wouldn't without the t-shirt, probably. He's older now and chunkier, and he didn't have those tattoos on his Disney show. But with the face and the name so close together, yeah, it's him." It wasn't entirely clear what the former child star was aiming at. Maybe it was an easy way to head off interruptions. "Excuse me, I don't mean to disturb you, but my friend and I were wondering if you were, I mean, you are the guy from that Disney show?" Or maybe it was purely promotional, just trying to keep his name front and center by showing it around a hip and industry-heavy coffee shop. Or maybe it was a sly and clever piece of performance art, forcing the viewer to compare the memory of the handsome, slim young teen with the paunchy, sort of homelessy 20-something guy with a croissant, uncomfortably reminding us all of the ravages of time and the reaper who cannot be avoided. Or maybe he's got a million followers on some social media platform that I don't know about, and the t-shirt is something he's selling, and the brands are lining up to get him to influence his audience, who I also didn't know existed. But that's the way Hollywood is these days. One day you're the biggest star for a certain age segment on the Disney Channel, and the next you're sitting anonymously next to me at a coffee shop near a guy with a million Instagram followers and a gigantic watch who, a few weeks ago, was behind the counter making coffee. And you're both famous and unfamous at the same time. And that's it for this week. Next week, we'll save Hollywood. This is Rob Long.
And Rob will be back next time with another much-deserved martini shot. And that is indeed the martini shot for this week's Culture File Weekly. Don't forget to follow Culture File on Spotify or whichever great reservoir provides your podcasts. The Culture File Weekly will be back next Saturday at 6:30 p.m. Till then, bye now.